there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us. This week, Renee did something different. She went on the subreddit Writing and did an AMA and Ask Me Anything. And I was looking at it and she got 77 comments.
I didn't. Most of those were mine.
Half of probably yours. But still, before we start our podcast, I was curious, Renee, what was the experience like doing the AMA?
You know, it does take like all day and people trickled in. I had a lot of anxiety. I was afraid I was going to get some trolls and like death threats and weird stuff, but it didn't happen. So it was okay.
I didn't notice when I scrolled to the bottom that there was one person whose comments had been removed by the moderator.
Yeah, he wasn't making a lot of sense. He didn't really have a question. It's like he wanted to just say something. And one of the things he did is he was questioning my background and authority. Mm-hmm. I ignored him. Somebody else, though, responded and said, well, if you go to the about page on her podcast, which is linked to the thing, you'd find this out. And then he just started talking about kids these days. And I'm like, okay. And I actually, you know, I just keep saying he, they. It could have been a woman. You never know. Could have been a 12-year-old. You never know. So she was complaining about Gen Z or millennials. And I was like, okay, now.
So what surprised you most about the experience?
I think I was a little surprised by people asking me whether or not I thought the MFA was quote unquote worth it for them because it's such a personal choice. But I think what they needed was somebody to like help make their decision. And that's not necessarily why I was on there, but that was interesting. I wasn't expecting a lot of that. I became more of like a counselor in that sense.
Well, of the things you listed, it was the most relevant to the people on the writing subreddit.
But yeah, I thought maybe they would ask more about like what happens after the MFA.
Uh-huh.
But if you haven't finished it yet, I guess you're thinking more about whether you should do it or not. So.
Yep. That's probably the people that are hanging out there on that thread.
Yeah.
Would you do it again?
Maybe if the question was different or if I was on there like talking about podcasting, I think I would totally do it. Or if it was specific to what people learn when they go get an MFA.
I thought you were really gracious in your responses. You seemed to like really focus in on what the person asked and answered it to your best of your ability. And it seemed like a lot of people responded thanking you too.
Yeah. You know, people were cool. They had genuine questions and I had genuine answers. That's the best part about teaching.
Do a lot of subreddits have their own AMA?
I wouldn't say most subreddits, there's thousands of them, but the ones that invite discussion and include some kind of expertise and advice, yeah, totally.
So would you recommend it?
Doing one?
Yeah.
Yeah. If the subreddit is full of advice or the same questions get brought up over and over again and they never seem to get fully answered, and if you're an expert, I think that that is a really good resource for people. Because people who don't have experience can't tell the difference between good advice or bad advice or what's real and what's not real. So having an authority on there is kind of nice to set the record straight. I appreciate it. I mean, I just read one recently about someone doing ultra running. I super appreciated that one.
Okay. That was your good deed for the week, I suppose.
My good deed for the week, yes.
And with that, let's go on to the podcast. So if you've gotten bored with scenes, do we have a treat for you? In this episode, we're tackling Chapter 7 of Scene and Structure, which introduces the sequel. What is a sequel? And what is in a sequel? And is this idea Bickham's a real thing they use in real books? And in the midst of all these questions, Renee has an existential crisis. Don't worry, she gets better. We've got a lot to cover in this episode.
All right, so this chapter,
we're changing gears a little bit. It's been seen, and now there's something else.
There is something else, and boy, is it something big. This chapter, chapter 7, is called Linking Your Scenes, the Structure of Sequel. So what the heck is a sequel?
I actually have some thoughts on that. He talks about two structural components, the first being transitions, which is just basically, and at this other place, this was happening. It's basically that little square that you have in your comic books whenever you switch from one place to another and say, you know,
right,
back at the X-Men mansion.
Right. Next Thursday.
Exactly. Meanwhile.
Yeah.
So those are the transitions. But then we have sequels. Do you want to give us a definition?
The sequel is the glue that holds scenes together and helps you get from one point to the next. It's in-depth characterization, analysis of motivation, explanation of character, and planning, etc.
Etc. That etc. is, I think, the, it's a catch-all. It's mm-hmm. like everything in your book that's not a scene.
But he has a very structured way. Well, not only does he have a structured way of telling us, because he is the bullet point king, but he's got a very rigid set of things that you should be doing in between your scenes.
He claims he has a very rigid set, but he also basically says that the sequel can contain some, but maybe not all of these things he discusses. And my issue is, I think he wanted something to balance the scene, and so he basically threw everything else into this thing called a sequel.
So what is a sequel? Say you've written your scene, dear writer, and the scene is now over. The dialogue is ended. The disaster has taken place. What happens next in your story? Well, it could be another scene, but most likely it will be something else. It will be glue, as Bickham says, that connects the scenes together. It's the stuff in the middle, and it's characterization, description. It helps get into the character's thoughts, all of these things that don't happen on stage, like he said in a previous chapter, where a scene has to happen on stage. So a lot of this stuff is internal. Some of it can be action, but most of it is internal.
We often use TV shows or movies to substitute in for examples when we're talking here, because people have seen these things, everyone knows about them. And when you're watching a TV show, it's one scene after another. It's actually kind of odd when you have a voiceover or something in between that would link the way a novel is. Often people will say, well, there's this really incredible book, but I don't see how they'll possibly turn it into a movie because there's so much internalization. So in this case, movies and TV shows and probably plays don't use sequels. Or rarely use sequels. This is something special to the novel.
I would say if there are sequels in a movie, it's a slow movie. There's a lot of pausing, and you just kind of have to be like, okay, that action is metaphorical.
I look at his definition. I'm not 100% sold on what he's saying, but I do recognize that the power in writing a novel is this ability to do the internalization. All the things he discusses in here are really critical parts to a novel and really powerful parts to a novel. I'm not sure if all these into parts aren't just independent by themselves.
So Bickham's theory is that your character finishes the scene, the disaster takes place, and then they have an emotional reaction. Here's like the basic parts of a sequel, the stuff in between your scenes. There's four stages. There's emotion, thought, decision, and action.
I find this replicates exactly what we mentally do as humans. We have an emotional response, we think about it, we reformulate our goal, and we go forward, and then we go to action. So it's a very natural progression. I totally buy that that's the natural reactions a person would have after a scene. But then when he's discussing them, sometimes he'll say, we start with an emotional reaction, then you go to analysis, and then back to the emotional reaction. Maybe you skip the goal and go to action. It feels like all these individual parts are important. But maybe they're there, maybe they're not.
Right. How necessary are they?
I think they're necessary, depending on you as the writer and the sort of story you're telling. But when you're working on scene, I really could see learning how to put all those pieces together. And this, it feels, I think it's going to be useful, but I don't think I'll make note cards to define what my sequel is.
Okay, so from my perspective, I've actually had this question genuinely as a writer. What goes in between scenes? There's so much focused on scenes. I mean, if you go on Scribd, I think it is, or other novel writing software, they've designed it so that each like square or post-it on there is a scene. And I know a novel is more than just a scene, right? There's other stuff. There's meat in there that can't be described as a scene. And it is actually, as a writer, always perplexed me about what goes in there. Why does it go in there when? What are the internal workings?
Another support to this idea you have is that whenever you're in a critique group, one of the most common feedback someone will get is, you've given this great scene, but I don't see any emotional reaction from the character. I don't see how it moves them forward. I need to get more. If you simply give a person the scene and then jump to the next scene, there's something missing for the reader.
Right. And in memoir workshops, you'll commonly hear people say after like a big scene, well, how did you feel? And you're like, well, how do I describe my feelings besides actually describing feelings, which is a really bad idea in good writing anyway.
I felt sad.
Probably not a good idea. Anyway, regardless of whether or not these things are in a sequel, this is how Bickham breaks it down. You can show emotion in three ways. You can describe it, like, I was sad. You could give an example, like throwing a tantrum, or your character could be very angry and throwing things around the room.
Some kind of externalization of what's going on inside. And this is stuff that TV shows and stuff will do. You'll see the actor communicating through their actions what's going on in their head.
And in a screenplay, you definitely have to do that. Everything is external. Then this one was interesting. Discussion. Sometimes characters will talk about their feelings.
Or talk about a situation or reinterpret. It's especially important if you've got somebody that isn't naturally very introspective.
Right.
That you force it out of them.
So if they're having a conversation, though, isn't that a scene?
That's what I was noticing. In his description of what a sequel is, once you get too much in the moment, once you start bringing externalization, it almost starts to feel like a scene. But maybe this is his way of dealing with those conversations in a story where you don't have antagonists. Because at some point in your story, you have to have two people together doing something and they're not necessarily going to be antagonistic. So maybe this is his way of saying, okay, all those conversations that don't fit a evolving conflict, well, they're part of this other thing.
All of these like very specific rules, it bothers me because it seems as if there's no room for there to be a variation, even though he's got a section in here on the variation of it. Like the fact that he says discussion, but that he just went to town on scenes in the previous chapters, it just confuses me.
Yeah. For Bickham, his scenes contain a conflict, and so any conversation in a scene needs to be furthering that conflict. Even his idea of a scene is that a scene always ends in a disaster. Well, what about those conversations that are part of the story where they don't end in a disaster? Well, I guess they're part of the sequel then.
I wish he would have made that point. I'm going to adopt that because that would explain to me why some scenes don't really have conflict.
When you need to get more information out to the audience, but you just can't put it into a darn scene, you make it a sequel.
Yeah.
So that's emotion. We all go through emotion, and then once we've had our emotion, then we start thinking about stuff.
So this is stage two.
Thought.
And of course, just like emotion, there are three levels that your character will go through. A three-part pattern. The first one is review. What do you think he meant by review?
What just happened? In the example he gives in his appendix, this woman has fallen through the floor of a cavern and has landed. But my guess is that scene ended with her falling. And then the review is remembering, you know, how she felt when she was falling.
Okay.
Or how she thought about it. That allows you to do a cliffhanger or something and to follow up right away with kind of the aftermath.
Okay. So a review is them just kind of replaying important things that have happened.
Yeah.
And like filtering it through their thought process.
So review is, let's talk about what happened. Analysis is, let's talk about why it happened. And planning is, let's talk about why I'm going to do the next thing.
Right.
And he put a lot of time into planning because he says often you as the writer know what you want your character to do next. But if you don't spend enough time planning, explaining why they're going to take this next step, then your audience isn't going to be on board.
So in his example of the woman that fell into the cavern, by all accounts, she should stay put and wait for someone to find her. And so what he did was he rehashed all the reasons why someone wouldn't find her. And if you look at the actual thing that's going on, it really does look like a conflict that she's going through all the evolving reasons why she should do it before she does the next thing. I think there's definitely some overlap between the techniques used in scenes and the techniques used in sequels.
Right.
I was thinking I would pick something for reading now to kind of give an example of this sort of thought process.
Yeah. Both the emotion and the thought?
Yes, although I'm picking one of my favorite listening series, Murderbot. And since Murderbot is not a person, it does not necessarily have emotions the same way.
But who's it by again?
This is by Martha Wells. And this is from her first book, All Systems Red. And it starts off, as many scenes in Murderbot starts off, after Murderbot has been knocked unconscious, all its systems have gone offline. And it's
figuring out what's
rebooting. Kind of. I came back online to no vision, no hearing, no ability to move. I couldn't reach the feed or the comm. Not good, Murderbot. Not good. So that's kind of a review. I got some weird flashes of sensations off my organic parts, air on my face, my arms, through the rips in my suit, on the burning wound on my shoulder. So there we got a bit of
emotion.
Emotion and told through example.
Told through example, yes.
I'm skipping some little parts here. The sensations were only for a second at a time. It was confusing and I wanted to scream. Maybe this is how Murderbots die. You lose function, go offline, but parts of you keep working. Organic pieces kept alive by fading energy in your power cells. Then I knew someone was moving me, and I really wanted to scream.
Oh, wow. That's all emotion.
Yeah.
Wow.
Then my organic parts started to sting. Numbness was wearing off. I was designed to work with both organic and machine parts to balance that sensory input. Without that balance, I felt like a balloon floating midair, but the organic part of my chest was in contact with the hard surface, and that abruptly brought my position into focus. I was lying face down, one arm dangling. They put me on a table? This was definitely not good. It goes on like that, but you can see this is all the stuff in its head as it's thinking about things, and it mixes and matches. Like, sometimes it's emotion, sometimes it's analysis.
So you would call that analysis, because I was thinking that whole thing was emotion.
I think that it was analysis in that we were getting information about where it was and what had happened previously. But yeah, you're right. It was more emotion.
Well, right, because there was no planning. Did he review what happened?
No, not exactly.
Maybe I'm just not seeing it. I just see emotion there.
You know, I have another example.
Okay, let's do that. This one everyone knows. It is Angelus Ashes by Frank McCourt. What happened was the mother goes up to Frank and says, you're going to take dancing classes. And Frank's like, I don't want to take Irish dancing classes. This is dumb because he's a boy and he doesn't want to do that kind of thing. Right. Not to say that boys don't dance, but Frank doesn't want to dance. But his mom's like, you got to do it. Your ancestors did it. This is cultural. Damn it. Get in the car. Well, they didn't have cars back then.
The setup is Frank was in a scene where he was being forced to dance.
He was forced to take dancing classes.
Okay.
So they show up on the first day and he says, if my pals see my mother dragging me through the streets to an Irish dancing class, I'll be disgraced entirely. They think it's all right to dance and pretend you're Fred Astaire because you can jump all over the screen with Ginger Rogers. There is no Ginger Rogers in Irish dancing, and you can't jump all over. You stand straight up and down and keep your arms against yourself and kick your legs up and around and never smile. My Uncle Paul Keating said Irish dancers look like they have steel rods up their arses, but I can't say that to ma'am. She'd kill me. To me, that is both emotion, but then also thought. Because he's reviewing, if my pals see me dragging through the streets to Irish dancing class. So he's reviewing the scene of his mother saying he has to go to Irish dancing class.
Right. And there's analysis in there, too.
It goes into, might look good on the screen, but that's not the kind of dancing that looks cool. And then planning. Is there a plan? Not yet, but it could be in the next paragraph. But no, he goes straight into scene. So I've read this book, and I've seen the movie, and the scene is essentially leading up to him actually making a decision. He decides to just take the money and pretend he knows how to dance. It could be that the thought process got pushed. So the next couple pages are mostly just a detailed summary of what it's like in the first and second class, but not too much detail. Like, it's not on stage. It is summary.
It is summarized, which is the thing you're not allowed to do in a scene.
Right. So essentially what he's doing is he's still analyzing, even though the situation is playing out. Well, then
something new happens. Ma'am says Fred Astaire went to his lessons every Saturday and I didn't go around kicking the toes out of his boots. And if I wanted to be like him, I'd have to go to Mrs. O'Connor's every week. The fourth Saturday morning, Billy Campbell, which is his friend, Billy Campbell knocks at our door. Mrs. Court, can Frankie come out and play? Ma'am tells him, no, Billy. Frankie is going to his dancing lesson. He waits for me at the bottom of Barrack Hill. And then there's a description of Barrack Hill and playing soccer. And then Frankie says, I tell him I'm finished with the dancing, that I have 6 pence in my pocket for Mrs. O'Connor that's supposed to go into the coffers, that I'm going to the Lyric Cinema instead. 6 pence will get the two of us in with tuppence left over for 2 squares of Cleves toffee. And we have a great time looking at Riders of the Purple Sage. So there's his plan. He decides he's going to take the money instead of giving it to the lady who runs the dancing, and he's going to go to the movies with his friend.
What could possibly go wrong with that?
Oh, he'll never get caught. Actually, it's a really good scene in the movie, too, at the end. All right, so it looks like it sort of does play out. Sometimes things get pushed between time, or summary happens in between these three steps, but it looks like, at least in the descriptions that we've seen, that they do these things, that there is an emotion and that there are review, analysis, and planning. Although the planning can get a little tricky.
It looked like this one actually went through the thought and then it did a whole bunch of summarizing of stuff and then it jumped finally to the planning.
Yeah, it's not a formula.
So Bickham says, for decision, you must make the new goal clear, which feels to me a little bit like defeating the point of when you have a scene and you have to make the goal clear, because aren't you just repeating it twice? Because I disagreed with this, I looked very carefully at his justifications. So part of it is strategic. Basically, you need to have a decision because it justifies why you even had the sequel. Why go through the emotional response, the analytical response, if it doesn't result in a goal of how to move forward? And then tactical, which is that it sets up for the next scene. It gets us ready to see, or it gets excited for the next scene. And then finally, it lays the groundwork for the scene goal that's to come. So I was thinking that if you technically have a decision that sets up a goal, and then you go into some action, if that isn't basically the same as a scene where you've got your goal and then the resulting action.
It could play out that way, where the decision comes out in a scene.
Yeah, or I think that he was setting up, like, say, person in a haunted house, super scared. You come up with a reason why for them to move forward. They make the decision they're going to keep going. The action is they reach for the doorknob and open the door. And then your scene starts immediately afterwards with them walking through the door. So you could have a very minor action. You could have something that's so short you don't even want to call it a scene, and it's tucked at the end of the sequel. But at the same time, you could expand on that. Like if, say, someone makes a decision, they've decided that they need to do this thing and they need to contact. And then you have a series of phone calls that are unsuccessful, that as opposed to telling them in the moment, you summarize until they get to like the person that's important for them to call. Let's move on to the variations. Let's say you have a cliffhanger. He gives the example of someone who, in the end of the scene, he's looking for this gun and the guy pulls that gun on him and says he's going to shoot him. Obviously, you don't have time to expand on what he's thinking at that point because the next scene's going to start with him getting shot or avoiding the gun or whatever. But the audience will be aware that the sequel didn't happen. He's saying often you might go back later in a bit quieter time where the character remembers what happened, either in a discussion or in his own head or whatever. That moment that guy pulled out the gun and I was thinking yada, 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 or my heartbeat went yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Bickham says that readers have been essentially trained through reading to expect these sequels. Made me think again of my composition class where I tell beginning college writers, hey, you know, you're writing for the academy here and we're all trained readers here. And when we're reading an argument, we demand evidence. We've been trained to look for it and to poke holes in arguments that don't have it.
And that's the critique group comment. I didn't feel the emotion here. I didn't understand why this was happening. You need to go more than just telling us what happens, but actually getting into it. It's the power that a novel has. It's the reason why it's not real life. We actually get to figure out why that asshole did that thing.
The story of my life. Which can occupy an incredible amount of time after you've encountered the asshole as you try to work it out. But in a novel, you have the satisfaction of why.
Right.
Or what happened next. Or, yeah.
So, this chapter, dear listener, this chapter made me feel like I was in a hurricane. It made me feel like I was in one of those crazy decision trees that were so complex and so intricate that I don't even know.
I wanted to highlight one other thing that I like. In that example you were reading, you discussed how there was basically a couple of paragraphs devoted to what his first and second lessons were, told in summary, so not as a scene. So he says, some novelists, for example, are more interested in their characters' reactions to events than the events themselves. We can find great chunks of a novel composed almost entirely of sequels to scenes that were skipped over. Basically, you're writing stuff in summary. You're writing your scenes in summary, and you're including emotions and analysis and all that stuff with it. You're jumping over slow parts, you're emphasizing. And then, I love this line, this is why I like it. This is a highly complex and specialized technique, and I don't recommend it. For the writer capable of handling it, however, it provides some advantages. And then it talks about the various things that you can do. You can condense, you can be more subjective, more interpretation, you can slow down something to really nail it. Bickham's basically saying, well, you can go and try that, but...
but good luck, sucker. You know, it made me think of high school teachers making their students write 5-paragraph essays. And it's them saying, well, you could write something more complex, but you might confuse the reader.
It's condescending. It is, and yet Bickham's point is... that particular technique works when you already know how to write your scenes. And you already know what's in those scenes. And you've constructed those scenes with a goal, a conflict, and a disaster. And if you just jump to the summarizing, you might not be including all the parts that are necessary for a scene. Because face it, how many times are you in a critique group where someone is just summarizing and people say, I really would love to have seen this in a scene with dialogue. I really would want to have actually gone through the process of them walking to the store and purchasing this or whatever else, because it's been written in summary. So what I got out of this is that this is an available technique and you will almost certainly have to use it in your novel at some point, but you better know how to write your scenes first.
Okay, so getting an MFA, going through that process, they do not teach this kind of guideline stuff. They'll teach you what's a scene, you know, they'll give you examples, but most... at least in my program, and also getting my creative writing degree in UCSC, it was based on reading. We weren't reading craft books. We were reading books. We were reading the thing we were trying to write. And we didn't have discussions about, well, you know, is there a sequel in here? Is there a scene? We would talk about conflict, but we were talking at it in a more like organic way and our reactions as readers, but not so much these very seemingly rigid guidelines. In English 1A, you know, critical thinking, that kind of stuff, sure. But I'm talking creative writing. I feel like it's being reduced down to something that can be easily analyzed when it is not easy to analyze a story because there's a lot of parts.
You're doing an MFA, a Master's in Fine Arts. You are not doing a Master in Genre.
So, okay, so we maybe need to reinforce that this is a page turner. He's focusing on genre fiction.
An MFA, it's not meant to do cookie cutters and to push out someone that can write.
Right.
They were pushing you to do more. And they weren't going to do the bullet pointing, do this, this, and this.
So there's a part of me that wants to just keep into that camp. I want to stay there. I'm like, no, this is too much. It's going to stifle creativity. And you're reducing the magic of creativity to these bullet points. But then there's a part of me that's like, Renee... aren't you sitting there at the computer, like, trying to figure out what to write next? And things aren't coming together and you can't figure it out. I'm very mean to myself. It's like, I want to believe in this stuff because I feel it's giving me this lifeline that I need. But then there's another part of me that's fighting it.
Now, in contrast, in my program, we talked about that kind of stuff all the time.
Really?
We did one where we were doing... feature writing or longer articles. The professor put together a collection of articles and we went through everyone and said, what's the opening paragraph? How do they do the opening? what's the nut graph, where they're describing what they're talking about. How did they set up the ending? And we analyzed all of them to look at all the different techniques. They taught us how to do all these things, with the idea being that once you had those set of skills, then you could do more. Like, there are feature writing pieces that break all the rules and go beyond any of the stuff we were learning. But the instructor, so what happened in the class was he was giving all these. Then he was showing us some of the really amazing features. And one of the persons like, but I want to know how to write that. And he said, I can't teach you how to write that level. I can teach you how to write this level. And by writing at this level, you will push yourself to that level. So this isn't going to teach you how to write your memoir, Renee, but this is going to teach you some of the structural elements that as you write, you can go beyond. I don't think that I'd particularly enjoy a book that was written purely to Bickham's specifications.
All right, so Renee had her existential crisis. Kim brought in the big guns, i.e. logic and sound thinking. And so this was a lot of information. It will be broken down into some chapter notes for you, dear listener. I will try to make sense of it for you, for myself. And do we have another example? You said that you had another example.
Oh, yeah. This is The Magicians by Lev Grossman. And this scene takes place after Quentin has proved himself that he's worthy of entering the Magic Academy.
To those who've not read this book, it's kind of like
grown-up Harry Potter.
Hipster Harry Potter.
Yeah. Afterwards, Quentin couldn't remember much of the rest of the night, except that he spent it there in the school. He was exhausted and weak. Like he'd been drugged. His chest felt hollow and empty. He wasn't even hungry anymore, just desperate to sleep. It was embarrassing, but no one seemed to mind. So that's a lot of emotion right there. Professor Van de Veg told him it was perfectly natural to be tired because he had just cast his first minor incantation, whatever that was, and it would wear anybody out. So that's a bit of summary of what was happening before. The next morning, it took him a long, confused minute to figure out where he was. He lay in bed, slowly piecing together his memories of the day before. It was Friday, and by rights, he should be in school now. Instead, he was waking up in an unfamiliar bedroom wearing yesterday's clothes. He felt vaguely confused and regretful.
That's the transition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like he'd drunk too much at a party with people he didn't know very well and fallen asleep in the host's spare bedroom. He even had a trace of what felt like a hangover. So that's kind of like a summary there. Here's an analysis. What exactly had happened last night? What had he done? His memories were all wrong. The events were like a dream. They had to be, but they didn't feel like a dream. And this room wasn't a dream. A crow cawed outside loudly and immediately stopped as if it were embarrassed. There was no other sound. So there's some analysis. And then we get some description of the room. He had to admit it was a highly satisfactory room. No danger signs yet. Maybe this wasn't a complete disaster. At any rate, it was time to get up, time to get it over with and find out what was going on. So that's a bit of like
planning
and kind of a goal. He got up and padded over to the window. The stone floor was cool on his bare feet. It was early, misty dawn, and he was very high up, higher than the tops of the highest trees. He had slept for 10 hours. He looked down on the green lawn. It was silent and empty. He saw the crow. It drifted by before him on glossy blue-black wings.
Action.
Yeah, or something. He does actually get up and walk to the window.
Gets up. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't explicitly state a goal. We're leaving him just looking out the window as opposed to like him going to the room to go find so-and-so and confront him.
Right. I mean, on a extremely basic level, one could argue that he does have a goal. It's to get up. But that's almost petty.
Or to move forward with this new life. That is definitely a sequel right there.
Oh, yeah.
But it's not so obvious as Bickham demands. Bickham says that it's harder to find sequels in books because of the editing. A scene is obvious. It starts with, this is the location. Someone is doing this. These are the characters. This is where the camera is. A sequel is more nebulous.
It's hard to find in a book. Well, if it's so hard to find in a book, then I don't know. I saw with what you just read, it was in there. Mm-hmm. It's the meat between the scenes. But did it have everything? Maybe.
And it flowed so well that somebody reading it wouldn't necessarily say, oh, this is a sequel. It's more like this is a continuation of the scene and building up to the next and just kind of this neat stuff that's happening. And I get a chance to look at what this Hogwarts looks like.
Here's a strategy. This is maybe how I'll take this. When I'm writing and my scene is over, I'm going to ask myself, what the heck do I do now? And I'm going to go to this chapter and I'm going to be like, okay, I need to include some of these things.
Bickham actually says,
only after study of the excerpt works on sequel planning of your own will you be ready to move on to the next chapter of this book. So we need to do some exercises. Bickham gives more than one option for extra work. And one of them is working through some sample workbook disasters.
So the first workbook disaster. A man very much in love with his wife learns that she is having a long-term, passionate affair. Instead of being hurt or outraged and confronting her or her lover, can you devise reactions and thoughts which would instead convince him to feel relief and decide to buy her a nice present while saying nothing?
So the idea is you really need the sequel here because it doesn't make sense what the person would be doing next if you didn't have that sequel. I think to make these work, you kind of do need all the parts of a Jack Bickham sequel.
Right. He does say to write a predictable sequel pattern and resulting new decision. But okay, it doesn't necessarily mean that the decision has to be predictable.
So predictable in the way he
have
set it
all
up.
All of the pieces.
Start with the emotion, go to the thought, come up with a new decision.
No, action and then decision.
No, decision, then action.
Decision and then action to goal.
Yes. Okay.
All right. Thus is thus.
Thus is thus. And now, after a bit of procrastination and last-minute writing, we come to our exercise part of the program.
Holidays tend to mess everything up.
But they're so much fun. So the assignment was to write a sequel based on a couple of different prompt options. How was it?
It was more difficult than it thought it was going to be. Some really makes it seem like you just follow these four steps and put these things in and it'll all make sense. But then you start doing it and you're like, okay, my character's having a thought. Would this be considered a thought? You know, like, I don't know. Are they really reviewing? What are they reviewing? Are they reviewing the whole story as a whole? Like,
I think one of the tricks is not to think too carefully about what they say goes into it, because that freezes you up. For me writing this, I focused on the idea that the logical response of my character was going to be different than what she actually did respond. And that was kind of how I guided everything. And then afterwards, I just kind of looked around and said, oh, there's my emotion. There's my review. So it wasn't too bad that way.
I'm very curious to see if I have all the things in there or if I'm labeling them correctly and if it matters. See, here's the thing. I mean, we just reviewed this chapter and it looks like there's so many different variations and exceptions that maybe in the end, as long as it works, it doesn't matter.
I think it might be that, but let's find out. When I was doing mine, because we'll talk about mine first, when we were doing all the Gardner exercises, we kept running the problem that we spent so much of the writing exercise trying to set up what the plot or the story was for the audience. So what I did was I wrote down a plot squeeze at the very beginning of my exercise, so you would know all the stuff that roughly had gone on beforehand, so I wouldn't have to introduce any of these things. My exercise was number 3. A young woman is told she has won a coveted scholarship to a medical school. Instead of pleasure and new plans to move to the school, can you devise a sequel that would have her burst into tears and logically decide to take a job at the local factory instead? So I had to develop a backstory. I decided that this scene would happen about a third of the way through this YA urban fantasy. This is the point where you've had all the setup and you're just about ready to plunge into the serious action. So this was going to be that sequel between those two parts of the book. I wrote, assume the scene happens about one third into a YA urban fantasy. Rose Branson has had a series of strange encounters with people who claim to be magic and that she is magic and that she is critical to fighting the forces of darkness that are led by Reince Durbin, who is also the father of Rose's ex-boyfriend. Very typical YA setup here. We don't need to know what particular prophecy is going on or what particular magic stuff she's been involved with. We just know that it's all been happening up to this point. And so the scene starts with the letter that she gets from the scholarship people. Dear Miss Branson, we are delighted to inform you that you have been selected as this year's recipient of the Curtis Ellington Medical Scholarship, which, as you know, provides not only full tuition to Harvard Medical School for 4 years, but also includes a yearly stipend for housing and school supplies. There was more to the letter, but Rose needed to read it from the beginning to convince herself it was true.
This solved all her problems. She was really going to be free of the town of Twin Oaks and all the weirdness of the past week. Her dream of becoming a doctor was coming true. It was as if so many burdens had been lifted, like she was flying. And that brought back the experience of yesterday, when the fortune teller had hypnotized her to think that she was walking on air. Even now, Rose could remember the cushioning feel on her feet as she hovered, or thought she was hovering, 3 feet above the ground. Rose stood up and paced back and forth across her bedroom, the wood floor firm beneath her soles. It hadn't been real. This was real, she repeated. Rose went back to the letter, and this time read it with satisfaction, with relish. Delighted to inform. This year's recipient. Full tuition. With each line, Rose's smile grew wider and wider. There was going to be a reception where she would officially be given her scholarship at some fancy-sounding conservatory in Boston on July 8th. July 8th was the next full moon, the night the supposed powers of darkness would rise up and destroy Two Oaks before being unleashed upon the rest of the world. She'd been looking forward to going over to the fortune teller's stall on July 9th when the town was still standing and laughing in his face, and now she wouldn't be here. She'd be in Boston. She felt that back of her neck dread, that guilt for not following through on something. This wasn't like that, she tried to convince herself. In this state, her eyes went to the signatures at the end of the letter, the committee who'd made the final selection. Catherine Gazy, Nathalian Tellis, and Reince Sturven. Reince Sturven? It couldn't be. Rose did a quick Google on the scholarship and her ex's father's name. There were the names of the select committees with photos. Reince Sturven's photo had that same predatory look he'd given her on those times that Chris had taken her over for family dinners. Rose remembered the disdain he'd shown her, the sharp bards of his put-downs, the way he dismissed her at every chance. And he'd chosen her for a scholarship? Why? Because he realized he'd been wrong to her about her? No, Reince Sturven never admitted to being wrong. Because he felt sorry for her? Unlikely. If her ex's father was turning over a new leaf, there were several more aggrieved persons ahead of her on the list. Because he wanted her out of town? But why? There was no chance of Rose and Chris getting back together. He was engaged. Why would he want her out of town if not? All the memories from last night's dream came back. It's all coming true, the voice had whispered. No, Rose spoke the words aloud, her voice breaking. She'd had all she ever wanted, and Two Oaks was nothing that she wanted. But if there was even a chance that it was true, the tears were really flowing. Rose let them come. If nothing else, she was entitled to some misery. But eventually her nose got stuffed up and she grabbed a tissue to blow it. She wiped away the tears. She made her decision, and now she was going to have to act on it. Rose opened up the webpage for Durbin Manufacturing and clicked on the tab for employment opportunities. There were several graveyard shifts open. This would be a chance to get information. Rose could taste the dried salt on her lips as she filled out the application.
Nice.
I don't think that when Bickham was writing these exercises that he would imagine that it would be, you know, set up for a YA magical urban story of saving the world.
When he wrote this, they didn't really have them. They didn't have that plot, or what do you call it, the formula of
the trope
of the young adult fiction plot. But I would say this kind of genre fiction is perfect for this book.
Absolutely. I picked this example because I didn't immediately come up with a good reason for why she wouldn't do it, but then I started brainstorming, and you know, once the Buffy Vampire Slayer-esque subplot came into mind, it was all there.
I wrote down Buffy, actually. Yes. About the forces of darkness. I really love the part where Rose goes through and interprets key words out of the letter that you threw in there. That captured exactly the relish, and she's going through each line. I don't know, I love that part, and the forces of darkness was fun. I like the plot twists where it's like, oh, this is a calculated plot.
Mm-hmm.
It felt a little rushed, but maybe not. It just gets the story moving forward.
Honestly, I was going for a good first draft of something without worrying too much about strict details or how it would all link up.
Yeah. On the surface, if this was in a book, I would not notice anything was missing. Like, without reviewing all of the things that you're supposed to have in a sequel, I'm on board as the reader.
The main question is it believable that we would expect Rose to first take the scholarship, and then is it believable that she wouldn't take the scholarship? That's the meat of this assignment. You're given a situation where it is logical that the character would pick one choice, but over the course of the sequel, you convince the audience that, in fact, they should be making a different choice.
It was almost there. The only part at the end was how fast she made the decision.
Mm.
I would think that she might lie to herself a little bit and really want to go and say, oh, whatever. Maybe it's not a big deal. Maybe it, whatever. But she would have to come around, given how much she really wanted to go. I thought she would maybe make more excuses.
So you're looking for one more still wants to go to college reasoning in there.
Or some like part in here where like time went by, like a little bit of time went by so that it felt like she chewed on it a little longer. Like she had to really struggle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's convinced too easily to let it go. I guess I just wanted her to have a little bit of denial, maybe.
Mm, okay.
Because that's what I would do. I would try to think of all the ways in which, no, it's okay. I can make this work. I could still go to college. But it's hard to do. It's hard to do that in just a few pages.
They probably would have fit really well to have a, I'll go to this one ceremony, but come back, or some sort of idea where she could try to do both at the same time and then have her have to abandon. So that would give it a bit more validity. But let's go over the different things that Bickham says should be in a sequel.
So the first thing, again, is emotion. And there's three ways to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Got the letter. I actually really like the letter. And then there was more to the letter, but Rose needed to read it from the beginning to convince herself it was true. To me, that is an example. It is an action. She is so excited that she has to read it again.
Right.
Was that your intention?
What I found is I didn't have like a section where we're just on emotion or we're just on analysis as much as it kind of flowed back and forth. So I think that first paragraph, the letter is like example, but then this solved all her problems. She was going to be free of the town of Twin Oaks and all the weirdness the past week. And that is much more review.
Right.
And then it was as if so many burdens had been lifted. She felt like she was flying. And that's back to emotion again.
Right. Then this next part, you know, and that brought back the experience of yesterday, which is a thought. So that to me is number two.
Yes.
You've got a thought and they're reviewing things that have happened in the past to make sense of them.
Right. Exactly.
She goes back to emotion. She starts reading the letter, but then she goes back to review with July 8th was the next full moon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then we have emotion again, or maybe emotion filtered with analysis. The fact that she's got the back of the neck dread, the guilt for not following through on something.
Uh-huh.
This wasn't like that. So this is her thinking about her emotional state. So she's analyzing the situation and how she feels about it.
Exactly. Yes. So, but a lot of the beginning of there was kind of the review mixed with emotion. And now we're going into analysis mixed with emotion.
Yeah. And then you've got the planning. You did it literally by her Googling the name of her ex's father's name. You want to plan something nowadays, you just go on Google.
That was more of still the analysis. She was trying to figure out what's going on. So she does the Googling. She has the whole analysis where she's going through and deciding why Reince Dervin might have given her the scholarship. So I think that's still analysis. And the planning stuff doesn't come. So he's got a section called planning, and then he's got the subsection called decision. I think I basically contracted all those things together.
Okay.
Because the first bit I saw for planning was Two Oaks was nothing that she wanted, but if there was even a chance that this was true. So at that point, she's coming on like a chance, something happening, planning. But then I'm back to emotion with tears. Then I had, she made her decision and now she was going to act. I've jumped over planning over into decision. I haven't even necessarily said what the decision is, although I describe then her going to the employment page and filling out an application.
Right.
Part of that was because I know that modern storytelling, often you don't show exactly what the next plan is, all the details of it. You just show enough for them to see what's happening. I didn't want to spend that much time in her head having her think, well, what am I going to do now? Well, I could try to gather some more information. How can I gather information? Well, maybe I find some information at the factory. How could I get in there, though? It's locked all the time. Well, they might need jobs. So I could have given that long bit, but that just felt like there's sometimes you want to get into a character's head and feel the emotions of what they're going through, or when they really make a critical leap of intelligence where you want to see how they got from here to there. And then sometimes, like, well, she's going to go to the factory and figure out what's going on. And like that point, you kind of fall on the tropes that are there, and people, audience goes, oh yeah, that's what's going to happen. They move on.
It also depends on the character too. Some are overly analytical and some just act.
Yeah. And I always get really annoyed by characters that are really wishy-washy on stuff too. Like, I like the idea that once a character makes a decision that they're moving forward, because I spent all the time in my own head trying to figure out what I'm going to do and whether I'm going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's a different genre, too. If you go for one of those thinking books where you're reading and you really want to get into the character and why they're doing certain things, it's very dripping in theme and imagery and symbolism, you know.
Or it's a deep exploration of an incredibly real person like we all are, and therefore really showing the minutiae of all the things that go into making various decisions.
Yeah.
As opposed to pure escapist fantasy, like, no, I want to get to the good stuff.
Yes. The range of analysis is wide. There's an examples across the board. I guess it just depends on your style. I would agree that the page turners probably don't dwell too much on thought process. That would really bore the reader.
What I found writing this was I was always linking emotion very tightly to any of the thinking stuff or planning stuff that went forward. Like, I was always jumping back to emotion to support the fact that this was my character making these decisions, that these thoughts you were having were important because they had an emotional impact on her, or her emotions were having an impact on that. And so I didn't really separate them out. The emotions stayed through the entire sequel.
I did notice that she was having emotional reactions to a lot of the things. Like, there's an analysis. Throughout the analysis, there's an emotion, right? She makes a decision. She has an emotional reaction to the decision she's making. That makes this a very high stakes scene. This makes it a high stakes reaction to a big decision.
A high stakes sequel.
Yes, a high stakes sequel, because she's making a huge decision. Actually, that is really wise. I'm surprised Bickham didn't talk about that tactic, because it works really well here. And you have to really show the reader that some big plot twist or plot event is happening and that the character is making sense. This does that. And putting emotion throughout the different stages was really effective here. In fact, I think that's important to do. I would add that into the book. If there was a revision and Bickham was alive, I think we should put that in there.
We'd be writing him a letter. Mr. Bickham, we have read your book and found it very useful. However, we were thinking that.
Right. Anyway, I love this because I read it and I could see it in a book. I'm like, yeah, this is what I would see in a book. It reads like something that would tie a scene to another scene.
Yeah.
And it used to be so nebulous, but now I'm identifying it. And it's, I don't know, I think it's great.
I think it shows that you have a lot of action that happens in sequels, too. It's not just a scene and then the sequel's kind of this sort of like in between fuzzy bit before you get to the next scene. Sequels have to do a lot of work on their own. And the sequels will use many of the techniques that you see in the scene as well to get the job done.
Yeah, you've got action in here. I mean, you know, she's opening up the webpage. She's Googling. She's doing things. But that's not necessarily a scene. Even though she does, well, I don't know. She does have a goal.
She's definitely in a location.
There's definitely some conflict.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so condensed. It doesn't really end in a disaster.
Right. And there's not an obvious opponent that she's battling against. So Bickham has the idea that the conflict is something that's external. And in a sequel, I think the conflict's often internal, and maybe that's one of the big differences.
Yeah, that's why we have all of these steps. How do you show internal conflict? Besides, you know, the example I gave in one of the show notes, which was Gollum,
mm-hmm.
right? He's having, you know, an external conflict with himself. So he's staring in the pool and sees his own reflection. And that's how he has a conversation, having a sequel where he's having thoughts about murdering the hobbitses.
I think whenever you have multiple personalities put into it, you're technically pushing it to the external conflict.
So the internal is breaking into the real world. So what did you get out of writing this?
I think one really powerful thing that a sequel gives you is the ability to twist the way the story is going, to really show why a character would change their mind to do something else, and the time to invest into that character to make that happen. Because otherwise you feel like you're constantly putting these action and these conflicts through. And the sequel allows you to give the time to really develop the characters in the direction of the story. I liked being forced to use that power of a sequel.
Are you going to continue to use this tool in your own book?
Well, I think I'll be aware of it. I'm not quite to the point where I can distinguish what is sequel and what is scene.
Okay.
But knowing that there's this terminology for this kind of in-between not scene writing might be useful as I'm planning stuff out or identifying problems like when people don't understand why the characters decide to do this thing. Maybe I need a sequel.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it's like, oh, my character didn't have an emotional reaction to this. Maybe that's what's missing. Mm-hmm. It can be used as a planning strategy, but it's also used as a revision strategy, like diagnosing problems.
Definitely I'll use it as a revision strategy.
Awesome. Well, Kim, I was very impressed with this. I think Beckham would have been proud. Would have been like, see? See? I told you.
Well, I think we've done a pretty good job of looking at this new concept of the sequel that Bickham gave us. And if you're ready for more sequel, in our bonus podcast on our Patreon account, we'll be going through Renee's exercise.
Yeah, we'll be going over mine.
Both of these versions will be available to our Patreon subscribers. Anyone who subscribes to our Abby tier has access to our bonus podcast, and you can enjoy listening to us further develop our techniques and figuring out what works and what doesn't work. And if you are really interested in improving your own craft, we suggest that you take a look at our Pinto, the Ambitious tier, where you'll have access to the actual exercises that we're working on with suggestions for how to try them yourself. And we'll have Renee's fantastic snark notes. What would you say your snark notes are instead of reading the book?
Yeah, they would be instead of reading the book. There are chapter summaries. They boil down the key concepts, but give more relevant examples, and they break everything down. It's almost like the textbook version of the book itself.
And if you're really, really interested in getting it all, we are offering a new level, our Azuki level, the fat cat.
Oh, she is cute.
She is very cute. She is very large. And at that level, we are going to open up our exercises so that if you are following along and you submit your own writing prompt to us, we will give an analysis and give you feedback for the first week after we release those. So, and you can always do it yourself and post it later on. But for the first week after they go up, we will be on top of anybody that submits their example.
Yeah.
Because deadlines are important.
Because deadlines are very important. Yes. Excellent. All right. Well, we'll see you in the bonus podcast.
In the meantime, thank you guys so much for subscribing. We have been having some really good numbers going up. And if you're liking what we're doing, we would love you to put a review on Apple Podcasts or a like button on wherever you're subscribing. And if you have a friend who's a writer that you think might enjoy the podcast, please pass it along. Thank you guys so much for listening.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
I've been writing all the words.
All the words.
That was actually pretty good. My teacher brain went on.